Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to episode 304 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we look at mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. In this episode, we're talking about listeners' weird questions. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today is Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
So it's another Fifth Friday, and we have another episode of Weird Questions from Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy and Cy Kellett. Jimmy, what topics will you be addressing today?
Should Elrond have just killed Isildur? Understanding the Divine Mercy Chaplet, reported time travelers from the future, teleportation clones and confession, Jesus aliens and salvation, Gulf War syndrome, Klingon baptism, ancient Egyptian spelling bees, Adam and Eve's belly buttons, and superhuman brains that don't have immortal souls?
Those are excellent questions. So let's listen to your answers.
Darren, I'm so glad you remembered, because I forgot all about the Weird Questions music. So it's a surprise to me that we're getting the cool Weird Questions music. That's very nice. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. I don't know how long we've been doing this, maybe a couple of years now, but it's a lot of fun. And Jimmy's got answers to a whole lot of things that a lot of questions that I never even knew that the question existed, never mind the answer. So it's always fun when Jimmy collects these questions up for people, get them to him via the various electronic means. And we have a lot of fun answering them. A lot of profound things come out during the Weird Questions hours, too. I always learn from it. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Cyril Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
And people should know this is how Jimmy and I talk to one another, even in casual settings.
just on the radio.
Yeah. But it's going to get weird in here, and I'm really looking forward to it, Jimmy. And weirdness is kind of your bailiwick. It's kind of your wheelhouse. You like living in this edgy area.
Yeah, I even have a bailiwick in my wheelhouse.
Do you really? Well, you got to be careful with that. That is the cause of some accidents. I think I know what a wheelhouse is. What is a bailiwick? Is that your like a politician's constituency or something?
It's one sphere of operations.
Yeah.
It comes from, originally it referred to the jurisdiction of a bailie or a bailiff.
Oh, that makes sense. All right. On we go to Weird Questions. Weird Questions, Jimmy. It's not a phone call thing. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the Weird Questions. I always do. It's fascinating to hear what people come up with. And we start with a question from Aaron. Jimmy, would it have been morally just for Elrond to have thrown Isildur into the fires of Mount Doom when he refused to destroy the One Ring as a way to ensure its destruction?
Okay, so this is a fairly straightforward moral theology question. It's applied to an event in the history of Tolkien's Middle-earth series. And if you've seen the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings movies, you may remember this scene because it occurs right towards the beginning of the first movie. Sauron, the evil overlord, has created this one ring to rule the other nine rings. Of power, one of which is in the possession of Elrond himself, because he is one of the ring bearers. He has one of the three elven rings. And the human king, Isildur, when all looks lost, takes his sword and chops off Sauron's finger. So Isildur, if you remember the movie, he's the finger chop-off guy. And he then takes the ring. Sauron's defeated. He takes the ring for himself. It eventually corrupts him and betrays him by slipping off his finger, exposing him to attack by orcs. So he gets killed And then later on, the ring passes into the possession of Gollum and eventually Bilbo Baggins and then Frodo, and Sauron's trying to get it back to cause untold evil in the world. And eventually it gets destroyed by being thrown into a volcano where it was forged, known as Mount Doom. So would Elrond, the elven guy who was there at that battle, would he, that original battle, would he have been justified once Isildur said, I'm keeping this for myself, to just
give him a shove,
abort the story and save future Middle Earth all the trouble by just throwing Isildur into the fires of Mount Doom? Well, okay, the answer is going to depend on a few things. The first thing it's going to depend on is how much destruction the ring is actually going to cause. And apparently for much of the next several thousand years, the ring really didn't do much. It was just in a cave with Gollum, or laying at the bottom of a river, or things like that. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until thousands of years later that it became as dangerous as it eventually became. It was just kind of dormant for most of that period. So the first thing is, the ring, in order to counterbalance the life of the ring bearer, Isildur in this case, it's going to need to do way more damage, or have the potential to do way more damage in order to justify a man's life as collateral damage. You know, okay. It's like in wartime, you can accept collateral damage. You can have an innocent person die because of what you do. Like if you need to, let's say it's World War II, you need to bomb a Nazi munitions factory, knowing that's going to kill the night watchman, who mm-hmm. may be an innocent person. But you can accept the death of an innocent as collateral damage, provided the military target has high enough value, because of the destruction it will cause. And even though it didn't manifest for a long time, I would say, yeah, the ring probably was a high enough value military target that it could justify the life of a single man as collateral damage. But that only gets us to the first hurdle. There are two more. The second hurdle is, Elrond needs to, in order to be able to morally take action, you know, to use violence to solve this problem early, he needs to reasonably foresee the danger that the ring will eventually pose. And it's not clear to me that, and you know, others know Tolkien's mythology better than I, it's very easy to say in hindsight, oh yeah, that was super dangerous, we needed to get rid of it. But in order to take action at the time, you need that knowledge at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear to me that Elrond knew that the ring was so dangerous it would justify killing Isildur. Because it did lay dormant for thousands of years before serious problems emerged. Also, Sauron had previously attempted to use it, is my understanding, and he tried to seize control of the three elven lords that had rings, and they immediately perceived what Sauron was doing and took countermeasures. Mm-hmm. So it's not entirely clear to me that Elrond would have had the knowledge needed in order to justify killing Isildur. So that's the second hurdle. It may be met. Maybe he had that knowledge. If so, in the story, he didn't act on it. Mm-hmm. The third hurdle is, you, in order to accept killing someone, they either need to be guilty or they need to be killed as collateral damage. And it's not clear that Isildur is guilty here, in part because Isildur apparently does not perceive the danger that the ring poses. And secondly, the ring may already be influencing him.
Yeah.
And he himself didn't really do anything bad with the ring, so he's not an active threat. He would have to be considered a non-combatant with respect to the ring. He was obviously a warrior, but he didn't do anything with the ring. And so you'd have to justify his death as collateral damage. And if he refuses to give it up and it poses a severe danger, well, you could throw the ring into Mount Doom, even though it's still attached to Isildur. Oh. And Isildur's death would then be collateral damage. It may have been a foreseen consequence of throwing the ring into Mount Doom, but it wouldn't be a means or an end to destroying the ring. So I can see a way that this could work, but how do I want to put this? So it's a really awkward when you lose your train of thought all of a sudden.
Oh, that's I was like, this is going to be good.
I know. No. I've got it back. So before you could throw the ring into Mount Doom attached to Isildur, though, you would want to take other steps that could spare Isildur, like doing an Isildur on Isildur. Elrond could chop whip out his sword, chop off the finger, and then throw that into the volcano, thus sparing the life of the human king.
Right. So you have to, you can't just go to the most violent and destructive scenario. You got to try to mitigate the evil.
Correct.
Yeah.
And if you're unable to mitigate the evil, then you could proceed to more aggressive means, but you need to explore those other options first.
It's fascinating to me how this question that comes from a very fictional story. I assume it's fictional. I'm not really good with world history, but I'm pretty sure there was no Sauron. But it does allow the illustration of how the Catholic mind and I suppose the well-prepared moral mind goes about making distinctions about when violence can be used and when it cannot.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Karen, thank you. That was very, very interesting. We'll be right back. Got to take a break. More weird questions for Jimmy Akin coming right after this. That's the weird questions theme music. And it's always nice when that's playing because it never plays unless Jimmy's here. And it's nice to have Jimmy here. But also, we got a lot of weird questions gathered up. And here's another one for you, Jimmy. Okay. I have one question about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I do not understand the words, Eternal Father, I offer you the body and blood, soul and divinity of your dearly beloved Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, in atonement for our sins and those of the whole world. Father and Son are one divinity, right? So how can I offer God to God when there is one God?
Okay, so what is being asked about is not what is often asked about, which is how can I offer Jesus to God in the first place?
Yeah.
That's a separate question. We've talked about that before. Specifically, what's being asked about is if there's one God, how can you offer the divinity of Christ to the Father when the Father is also the one God? Well, I think the answer here is to be found in the fact that Jesus is God. He is a person that has a divine nature, and Jesus himself offers himself to the Father. So what he's offering to the Father is himself, which is a person with a divine nature. So he's offering a person to the Father, and that person happens to have a divine nature. But there is a distinction between the person of the Father and the person of the Son. They both share the one divine nature, but they're two persons. And what is being offered to the Father is the second person of the Trinity. And so in the Divine Mercy prayer, when the expression, I offer you the body, blood, soul, and divinity of your dearly beloved Son, when that language is used, well, that's referring to the second person, body, blood, soul, and divinity. That's the person of Jesus Christ. That's just a way of enumerating the different components of that person, because he has divinity from all eternity. And then when he took on human nature, he acquired body and blood and a human soul. But really, the phrase body, blood, soul, and divinity is a way of referring to the entire person of Christ. And that's what Jesus himself offers to the Father, is his entire person. And we're simply participating in that act. We're endorsing that self-offering of Christ to the Father in the Divine Mercy prayer.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. I don't think I said the person's name who asked the question, and I'm going to try now because I don't want to be rude.
It's Polish, if that helps.
Oh, it doesn't help at all. you want to try? You want to save me from this? Or
well, I haven't looked up Polish, I believe it's Polish. I haven't looked up Polish phonology, but I would attempt it as Papusiawi.
Okay. And thank you so much for that question, person who Jimmy just said. This next one comes from Brian. Have there been any documentaries or at minimum speculations of people who have claimed to come back in time from the distant future with perhaps a story to tell of what is heading our way?
Oh. Yeah, there have been a lot of time traveler reports, and I've looked at one of them on Mysterious World, the case of a guy named Paul Amadeus Dinock, who allegedly lived in the early 20th century and then went into a coma and experienced life in the 40th century before returning to the 20th century with information about the future. That's episode 169 of Mysterious World, and you can go directly to it by going to mysterious.fm/169 for episode 169. So listeners who want to hear that can learn all about Paul Amadeus Dinock at mysterious.fm/169. And there have been others. The most famous probably time traveler account is about a guy named John Titor, but he didn't claim to go to the distant future. He claimed to be a time traveler from the mid 21st century who had gone back to the 1990s in order to pick up a computer part that was, or a computer that was desperately needed in the future because it wasn't manufactured anymore. So far, none of the accounts that I have, I haven't done a huge amount of work with time traveler stories yet, but I am waiting to encounter one that that I think meets, that has actual good evidence for it.
So a guy came, he said he came back from mid 21st century needing 1990 computer technology.
1980 computer technology, yeah.
Oh, all right.
And they he made some predictions, some of which kind of seem to come true, but others of which have not.
Oh, all right. Well, so they don't have like Best Buy in the future.
Well, apparently, if they do, Best Buy doesn't have 1980s model computers in stock.
That's a good point. All right. Thanks, Brian, for that question. I haven't listened to the Paul Amadeus Dinock one. Now I'm going to have to listen to that. That's because I don't even
like, pretty wild.
Yeah. But I like, even if it's a fiction, I'd be interested in what the guy came up with fictionally.
It's a very different 40th century than the 20th century.
Well, let's hope so. This one comes from Paul. Jimmy, if you were involved in a teleportation accident, and who other than
who
Jimmy
hasn't been at this point,
who's more likely than Jimmy Akin to be in a teleportation accident that created a duplicate of you? I see a Commander Riker parallel here. Would that person have to confess your sins?
Okay. It's going to depend on the way the teleportation works. But to stick with a common understanding of how this could happen, basically a teleportation accident that duplicated you would be a form of artificial twinning. Now, normally when twinning occurs, it occurs very early after conception. And this would simply be a case of artificial twinning later in life. Well, each person has a body, and every body is animated by a soul. And so each body has a different soul. So if you have identical twins, they have two different souls, and therefore they are not guilty of what the other twin has done, and they only need to confess what they've done. So if I'm in a teleportation accident and a twin of me is created, that twin is a new person with a new soul. They may have my memories, including memories of sins I've committed, but they are a separate person. They are not guilty of those sins. Hmm. So they wouldn't need to confess my sins. What they would need is to go get baptized.
Oh,
because
yeah,
they're a new person. They're not baptized. They're not confirmed. They haven't received Christian initiation. They may have 50 years of experience in their mind as a Christian, but sacramentally, they are not yet a Christian. So they'd need to go get baptized and confirmed and receive the Eucharist. And then they would need to confess whatever sins they may commit in the future. But teleportation accident, as I'm sure you know, you remember, Cy, it's not always clear who's the twin.
Yeah.
Who's and the real so, writer? Yeah. And so how do you know which one is the new being and which one is the one actually guilty of the sins? What do you do in that case? Well, what I would recommend doing in that case, if it's not clear who the twin is both people need to receive conditional baptisms and conditional confirmations, you know, using a formula like, if you are capable of receiving baptism, I baptize you. And if you're capable of being confirmed, I confirm you. And that will make up the lack of baptism for whoever the new person is.
Yeah.
And then, because it's not clear which one of these two people committed the sins, they both need to make a conditional confession and say, I have memories of committing these sins, and if I committed them, I repent and I want forgiveness for them. And then they could be absolved. And then that would take care of it no matter who the twin is.
And then some kind of consequences for the teleporter operator who created this mess in the first place.
Indeed.
This one comes from Paul, Jimmy. If Christ died to redeem all, would alien scriptures reference an alien redeemer? Or are all aliens unfallen, thus not needing revelation and salvation? There's a lot more to this question. Let me just read the whole thing.
Yep.
Related to this, if Satan knew that the incarnation would occur on Earth, did he then ignore aliens, thus leaving them unfallen? Therefore, if and when humanity travels to the stars, might we be the cause of their fall? Continuing on this theme, since working with tools was a punishment due to original sin, it could be argued that technology is a sign of a fallen species. Since we haven't seen any evidence of ETs, might that be proof that aliens are unfallen?
Okay, so we'll have to finish this on the other side of the break, but to get started on it, if Christ died to redeem all of humanity, we know that. Mm-hmm. If God chose, he could apply the grace of Christ's redemption to all fallen beings. And alien scriptures might mention, hey, there's this savior that's going to be born or has been born on another planet, and one day we'll learn about it. On the other hand, aliens, as Paul mentions, might be unfallen and not in need of redemption. Another possibility is Christ, if God can incarnate here, he's omnipotent, he could incarnate elsewhere too if he chose. So he might incarnate on another planet as well as having incarnated on Earth. Related to that, we don't know, because we don't know if intelligent alien life exists for sure. We don't know whether they'd be fallen or not. There has been speculation that we could prompt extraterrestrials to fall. In fact, that possibility is the premise of one of C.S. Lewis's novels in his space trilogy, where we go to Venus and they're having their testing period. And are we going to corrupt them is one of the issues on the table. But there's more to say, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Adam B., Mark B., Nellie B., Lynn Z., and Pat D. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by DeliverContacts.com, offering top brand contact lenses at always low prices with free delivery. Visit DeliverContacts.com. And by Tim Shevlin's Personal Fitness Training for Catholics, providing spiritual and physical wellness programs and daily accountability check-ins. Strengthen yourself to help further God's kingdom. Work out for the right reason with the right mindset. Learn more by visiting FitCatholics.com.
Music makes me feel weird. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. And we've got all the questions we need. They get sent into us. We have to vet them, as a matter of fact, to make sure they are weird enough. And sometimes on the show, when people call in, they'll say, well, this is probably too weird. You might want, and it never is too weird. I've never once had the person who claimed the question was too weird be right. We always are like, no, we can go weirder than that.
Yeah, my policy ever since Catholic Answers Live started has been I always want to give a straight answer to every question.
Yeah.
I don't want to mock anybody for their question that they're asking. And so no matter what the question is, I'll give it a straight answer. And people eventually noticed that I was doing that, which led them to start asking me.
Right. You know, right.
Weirder questions, which led to the show.
Yep.
Weird questions.
Yep. As a matter of fact, we call those questions here. We have a name for them. It's called a Jimmy Akin question. That's a Jimmy Akin question. So, Jimmy, you were responding to Paul, who wanted to know about Christ and the redemption of aliens.
Right. So, by the way, I'll also mention I have done a Mysterious World on aliens and religion, and you know, what would it mean if we found them? Like, could we baptize them, and could they be priests and stuff like that? That's episode 55. So you can go to mysterious.fm/55 for that. But Paul's last paragraph, he was asking about, he said, since working with tools was a punishment due to original sin, it could be argued that technology is a sign of a fallen species. Since we haven't seen any evidence of ETs, might that be proof that aliens are unfallen? Well, so I think there are two issues here. The first one is I don't see tool use in scripture as being one of the signs of the fall. Mm-hmm. Adam is cursed so that his work is going to be difficult compared to what it had been when he was the gardener of Eden. But since he was commissioned to take care of the Garden of Eden, and if you're taking care of a garden, you normally use tools to do that. I would assume he would be using tools before the fall. So I wouldn't see. And I think that's what would have been in the mind of the biblical author, as you know, this. In early Genesis, it contains lots of symbolism, so we shouldn't think about this too literally. But in the mind of the early author, if you're taking care of a garden for a monarch, which is what the Garden of Eden is, it's like the God's pleasure garden. God is the king, and this is his pleasure garden, and Adam is his gardener. He would expect him to use tools just like other gardeners taking care of monarchs' pleasure parks would. So I don't think I agree with that principle, but even if we granted it, it wouldn't show that aliens are unfallen, because aliens could have fallen and not developed technology. That would be one possibility. Or they could have fallen and just not developed technology that we can detect yet. I mean, in our own species history, it's only been in the last little more than 100 years that we've been doing stuff that, you know, like sending out radio signals that would indicate a technological civilization here. And if you go back a little bit further, you could, if you had aliens looking at the composition of our atmosphere at a distance, they could have seen industrial activity maybe in the 19th century. But that's the last 200 years or 150 years are a tiny portion of our history. And so for most of our history, we did use tools. We did use technology. It just wasn't sufficient to change our planet or otherwise broadcast our existence in a way that was detectable by other species at a distance. And so the same thing could be true here. There could be lots of aliens out there who are fallen and are using technology. They just haven't built a Dyson sphere or, you know, mega structures in their solar system that we could detect yet.
Thanks very much for the question, Paul. Next one comes from Tom. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. All the questions are weird enough. They made the cut. And Tom asks this. This is a very funny question to ask Jimmy, but all right. What are your thoughts on Gulf War syndrome?
Okay, so Gulf War syndrome, for people who may not be familiar with it or have a clear memory of it, is a set of conditions that were being reported by American servicemen after they came back from the 1990 to 1991 Gulf War. Mm-hmm. This is a decade before 9/11, so don't think the Iraq invasion or mm-hmm. that. This is a decade before that. And they came back. This was a war that fought against but did not topple Saddam Hussein. And they came back and they're reporting rashes and fatigue and brain fog, you know, cognitive difficulties that are abnormal and that don't go away easily. And actually about a third of the service members who were deployed there came back reporting symptoms like this. And so it became known as Gulf War Syndrome or Gulf War Illness. And initially, there were a lot of attempts to dismiss this as a psychogenic illness, meaning one that had its origin in psychology rather than physiology. Mm-hmm. The idea was that they went over into these dangerous conditions and, you know, people suffer traumatic psychological experiences when they go into war. That's what, you know, leads to shell shock, as it was known in World War One, or post-traumatic stress disorder, as it's known today. And so the idea was maybe they went over there and the exposure to the dangerous battle conditions and all the talk about weapons of mass destruction, maybe they came back and these conditions were something they were experiencing because of the psychological trauma they'd gone through rather than exposure to some physiological thing. On the other hand, there were speculations about what might account for it. Like maybe, you know, there are a lot of oil wells were set on fire at the time. Maybe it was exposure to chemicals from the oil wells that were burning, or maybe it was particulate matter that was in the air, or, you know, something. And there was this big debate about it, and different studies have been done that kind of different studies point in different directions. So mm-hmm. What has happened is the Veterans Administration has been providing help to sufferers of these conditions, to people who report them, but there still seems to be something of a debate about what's the exact origin of this condition. Is it psychogenic or physiogenic? Well, the most recent thing I can report is actually from just last month. In May of 2022, a new study was released. And what they did in this study was they considered whether exposure to sarin nerve gas and a particular soldier's DNA might be involved. And what they did was they went to servicemen who had deployed and they asked them, they looked at their genes, they took DNA samples, and they asked them, did you hear nerve agent alarms go off during battle? Because there's no way to go back and actually map, you know, exactly if nerve agents were released, where were they released and how, who was exposed. So they, as a proxy for that, they just said, did you hear nerve agent alarms go off in battle? Because they would bring those, you know, to tell soldiers to get their gas masks on.
Yeah.
If a nerve agent release is detected or suspected, they sound the alarm, everybody puts on their mask. Well, what they found was that that the incidence of Gulf War symptoms was much higher among those service members who, one, did hear nerve agent alarms go off, and two, who had the weakest version of a gene that allows our bodies to process pesticides.
Oh, wow.
And so the proposal is that these service members were exposed to the nerve agent sarin and that they had a weak version of the gene that allows us to process toxins of that nature. And so they were affected by it mm-hmm. in a way that other service members who had stronger versions of the gene were not affected by it, because people with the stronger versions of the gene could process it better and eliminate it from their systems before it could do damage.
That is some fascinating research. I'm really glad that that person asked that question. That was Tom. Tom, thanks very much for the question. More weird questions for Jimmy Akin coming up right after the break, but we got to take this break, so we'll be right back. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We try to have some fun on Fridays, and I always find it fun to talk with Jimmy Akin about these weird questions that people sent in. This one comes from a priest, apparently from a priest. Father Matthew is the name he gave, so I'm going to assume he's a priest. If a family wanted their child baptized in Klingon or a pre-Christian Babylonian language,
like Akkadian,
assuming an accurate but not Vatican-approved translation, would it be valid? This is obviously theoretical, but speaks to the point of whether a translation or interpretation is assumed to be valid or not before any Vatican intervention on the text.
So the presumptive answer, I would say, is yes, but with a caveat I'll get to. The presumptive answer is yes, because you don't have to have the Vatican intervene to approve a baptismal formula in order to make it valid. You need Vatican approval to make it licit to use in the liturgy, but not to make it valid. So, you know, as the gospel was spreading across the globe, Christian missionaries were baptizing people, and they were doing it in languages before the different congregations of the Vatican were even set up, you know, where it was just St. Peter and a couple of assistants, and they weren't passing on every new translation of not every new translation of the baptismal formula was being passed by them. And so you had lots of people getting baptized. The formulas are perfectly legitimate. Now, the question would be, what about in a constructed language like Klingon, or a language that doesn't have a native community of speakers, like, say, Akkadian? Mm-hmm. Which is one of the pre-Christian Mesopotamian languages. Well, there are people there are language communities for both of these languages. Even though Klingon is a constructed language, there are people who speak Klingon. And even though very few people today speak Akkadian, there are scholars who do, you know, that translate Akkadian tablets from Babylon and so forth. So both of these have language communities, and therefore it would presumptively be valid. But there is a little bit of a question in terms of, well, how far can we push this? Suppose I, Jimmy Akin, created a constructed language that is unrelated to any other language that's ever existed. I just make up a new language and nobody speaks it but me. And let's suppose the only thing I make up in this language is the baptismal formula.
Okay.
And let's suppose that in this language, a single word corresponds in meaning to the entire baptismal formula. So I make up a word. Let's say it's the word dop.
Dop.
D-O-P. Okay. Dop. And in this conlang or constructed language, dop means I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And I'm the only person who knows that. Could I validly baptize somebody by pouring water over their head and saying dop? Well, that sounds this is a language, and languages can work like that. And there is at least one person in the language community, namely me. But this is getting so far on the fringe. I'm not sure what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith would say if you ran this past them. They might say, well, regardless of how a language gets there, it, you know, baptism is a communal act. And having a purely private language is something that might not be valid for a formula, because the child the person is being brought into the society of the body of Christ, and the language needs to have some kind of user base for it to be valid. On the other hand, they could say, no, as long as it's a language, and even if it's such a simple one like this, maybe it would work. So I think there is reason to question as we get more extreme. But thus far, the Congregation, or now the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, has not ruled on those parameters. But and they may one day. But the presumption is, if this is a language, whether it's constructed or not, because all languages are really constructed over time by a community of users. But as long as there's a user base for it, the presumption would be that it's valid as long as it means the right thing.
All right. Father Matthew, thank you very much for that question. Jimmy, I have a weird question. I forgot to tell you this, that I'm going to put on for the next time, because I was driving in this morning. And I was listening to the radio, and they had the National Spelling Bee, And then they played the recording of the girl spelling like 16 words in 90 seconds that I never even heard of these words, never mind could spell them. So I had this question, and I know you know a lot about ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. And my question was this: would it have been possible to have a spelling bee in ancient Egypt? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, it would have.
Oh, okay. So you already know the answer. Okay.
Yeah.
But you understand why I asked the question, right?
Well, because they use a hieroglyphic script.
It's non-alphabetic. Yeah. Language, right.
Except it is.
Oh, it is. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I should have just known you'd know this.
Yeah. Hieroglyphs are and there's several different versions of the script, but hieroglyphs are a composite script that includes both symbols that like stand for concepts, which are like ideograms, like they use it, or logograms, like they use in Chinese, but it also includes an alphabet.
Oh.
And so it's a mix of both alphabetic and non-alphabetic symbols. So what you'll do, for example, is if you're talking about the queen Cleopatra, you'll spell out her name phonetically.
Okay.
Using the alphabetical characters, and then you'll put what's called a determinative afterwards, or sometimes called a classifier afterwards, that's the queen symbol to say, oh, we're talking about the queen Cleopatra here.
Oh.
You also draw, you know that kind of loop that you see around the names of pharaohs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's called a cartouche.
Yeah.
Well, that loop is it's both a protective magic circle. Mm-hmm. To protect the monarch, but it's also a character that only the pharaoh gets to use around his name. So it's a non-alphabetic character that tells you we're talking about a pharaoh here. Incidentally, the reason it's called a cartouche is because cartouche is the French word for cartridge.
Oh, and
when Napoleon soldiers went over to Egypt on their expedition, they'd see the cartouches in the carvings and say, oh, those look like cartridges. So they got called cartouches.
I got my weird question answered. I was going to save it for next, because my image was, you know, how they say to this little girl who won. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she's little or not, but she's amazing. And she's like, you know, spell this word. And she's like, P-H. And my thing was like that they would be like in the ancient Egyptian one, like spell Amun Ra. And then the kid would be like, picture of a chicken with a dot over it, picture of a house with, you know, like that you'd have to do that whole thing. But I guess not. They had an alphabet, huh?
They had an alphabet, and although the spellings can get interesting in Egyptian, because they don't just always spell a word from front to back the way from beginning to end the way we do.
Oh, they make it more challenging, huh?
They would adjust the words based the placement of the letters based on various considerations, including artistic ones, because you know Tumart is art.
Yeah.
But also out of respect for the gods, many of their names were theophoric, meaning they bore the name of a god within them, like Amun-Hotep. That's a reference to Amun, the hidden god, and Hotep means is pleased. So Amun-Hotep means Amun is pleased. Well, some people had the theophoric element at the back of their name, like Hotep Amun. But out of respect for the god, if you're spelling out Hotep Amun in hieroglyphics, you're going to yank that god symbol up to the front. And have Amun come first, because you don't want to be putting the god in the caboose.
Mm-hmm. No, you do not. All right. The next question comes from Shad. And Shad asks, and I believe that Matt Pinto, the founder of Ascension Press, put him up to this. Did Adam and Eve have belly buttons?
Well, it depends on a couple of things. The first one it depends on is how did Adam and Eve come into being? Now, the account that is found in Genesis depicts Adam as coming into being as kind of a statue that's made out of dirt that God then animates. So he's kind of like Galatea or Pygmalion from Greek mythology. And then Eve is made from a rib from Adam's side. And by the way, the claim that women have fewer ribs than men because of this or vice versa, that's not true. We got the same number of ribs. Well, on that account, Adam and Eve were never in a womb. And or at least there's no mention of them being in a womb. And if they were not in a womb, then it would be up to God whether he created them with umbilical cords or not. What the belly button is it's essentially a scar, but it's what's left when the stub of your belly button or the stub of your umbilical cord falls off after birth. Your belly button is not determined by the doctor or anything like that. When they clamp or cut your umbilical cord, they don't take it all the way down to your stomach. They leave a stub there, and then eventually that stub falls off and the belly button forms. So it would be up to God if he like had Adam and Eve with stubs of umbilical cords when he created them. That would be up to him to decide. On the other hand, this is early Genesis, and so it involves a lot of symbolism, and the church has already indicated that there's not a problem from a faith perspective in holding that Adam and Eve, our first parents, would have had biological ancestors, yeah. And that this is actually these accounts in Genesis about their origin are really affirmations of the equality of woman and man and of the fact that man is part of the earthly creation. He's not an angel. And so the church has no problem with saying that God used evolution to produce Adam and Eve's ancestors and then Adam and Eve themselves. And if that's the case, they would have been in wombs. Even though they're the first humans, they would have been in the wombs of their almost human parents, and then they would have had umbilical cords, and their umbilical cords would have fallen off, and they would have had belly buttons.
All right. Thank you for the question. Jimmy, do you mind if I skip one? Because there's a question I really wanted to get to.
Fine.
All right. So Jason asks this. Is it possible for a species, such as an alien or an understudied cephalopod, to have a powerful brain comparable to or even greater than our own, but not an immortal soul?
Well, as phrased, I would say yes, because we are very likely in the near future to have we may have in the near future artificial intelligences of a machine nature that can outcalculate a human. We already have many computers that can outcalculate humans in specific things, but it like they can beat humans at chess now.
Yeah.
But even if you made an artificial intelligence that had enough general intelligence to outthink a human, it wouldn't have a soul because it's not alive.
Yeah.
Souls are what make living things living. And so if you can have an AI that has post-human calculation abilities but no soul, is certainly not an immortal soul, then in principle, I don't see why God couldn't give a biological organism like a cephalopod. So for that, think octopus and squid, because they're really, really – really smart compared to a lot of animals, or an alien species, the ability to outcalculate a human. They would have a soul because they're alive, but whether it's immortal or not is going to be up to God. Now, there is a common opinion historically that humans have immortal souls because we have rational souls. But if you study the arguments for that, I think they're not nearly as certain as has often been claimed. I think it's more ambiguous. Is there a relationship between immortality and intelligence? I think we need to question that and think carefully about it. I tried to do that actually in an episode of Mysterious World. It's episode 203 on animal afterlife. So people could go to mysterious.fm/203 and hear my discussion of, is there a link between intelligence and immortality or not? And if so, what would we need to see to establish that link?
Very good. All right. Thanks for letting me skip one. And Jason, thank you for a very, very interesting question. That one stuck out to me when I first saw it. Well, that'll do it for us. And Jimmy, thank you very much for another very fine and slightly weird hour.
Thank you. And Klaatu Barada Nikto.
Hi. Wait, what's the guy's name?
Klaatu.
Oh, Klaatu. Yeah.
Speaking to Gort. But those are the words that saved the world in the day the earth stood still.
So I think I'm Gort in this. I think in this scenario, I think I'm Gort.
So you're saying you won't destroy the Earth?
No, I will not. I will not. Oh, but good. I'll look cool not doing it.
And now it's time to hear from you, the listeners. What are your theories about the topics we covered in the weird questions that Jimmy answered today? You can let us know by visiting sqpn.com or the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World Facebook page, sending us an email to feedback@mysterious.fm, sending a tweet to @mys_world, visiting the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or calling our Mysterious Feedback line at 619-738-4515. That's 619-738-4515.
And I want to say a special word of thanks to Oasis Studio 7 for the video and animation work on this episode. You can check out their work by going to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And while you're there, be sure to like the video and comment on it, because that tells YouTube you found it engaging. And so other people will find it engaging and they'll show it to other people. So you can help us grow. Also, I am trying to grow my channel in terms of subscribers. We recently passed 50,000. We're on our way to 100,000, but we won't make it without your help. So please do subscribe to the channel and be sure to hit the bell notification so that you always get notified when I have a new video. Mysterious World comes out at least once a week, but these days I tend to have more than one video per week going up.
So Jimmy, what's our next episode going to be about?
Next week, we're going to be telling you the story of Kincaid's Cave. In 1909, the Phoenix Gazette reported that an explorer named G.E. Kincaid had found a cave in the Grand Canyon that had been extensively excavated. It wasn't just a natural cave, and it contained mummies and artifacts that appeared to be Egyptian and Asian. It said that the Smithsonian Institute was looking into the cave, but was preventing anyone else from looking into it. And later researchers have accused the Smithsonian of performing an intentional archaeological cover-up. So we'll be looking into the story and getting to the bottom of the cover-up charge.
Excellent. Folks, be sure to check out the Mysterious World bookstore at mysteriousworldstore.com for links to all the books and videos that Jimmy mentions in the show. You can find links to Jimmy's resources from our discussion on our show notes at mysterious.fm/304. And remember, to help us continue to produce the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you in part by The Grady Group, a Catholic company bringing financial clarity to their clients across the United States, using safe money options to produce reasonable rates of return for their clients. Learn more at GradyGroupInc.com. And by Great Lakes Customs Law, helping importers and individuals with seizures, penalties, and compliance with U.S. customs matters throughout the United States. Visit GreatLakesCustomsLaw.com. And by Rosary Army, featuring award-winning Catholic podcasts, rosary resources, videos, and the School of Mary online community, prayer, and learning platform. Learn how to make them, pray them, and give them away while growing in your faith at rosaryarmy.com and schoolofmary.com. Until next time, Jimmy Akin, thank you for exploring with us our mysterious world.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on StarQuest. If you've enjoyed Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you'll also enjoy another StarQuest Network show, The Secrets of Middle-Earth. Find it wherever you can find podcasts or at sqpn.com/Middle-Earth.